Chapter 72. In midsummer, in the Zambezi Valley, the heat is a solid, white, shimmering thing. In the noonday, nothing moves in the merciless sunlight. At the center of the native village grew a baobab tree. A monstrous, bloated trunk with malformed branches like the limbs of a polio victim. The carrion crows sat in it, black and shiny as cockroaches. A score of grass huts ringed the tree, and beyond them lay the tilled fields. The millet stood tall and green in the sun. Along the rude track towards the village came a Land Rover. It came slowly, lurching and jolting over the rough ground, its motor growling in low gear. Printed in black on its sides were the letters ARC, African Recruiting Corporation. The children heard it first and crawled from the grass huts, naked black bodies and shrill, excited voices in the sunlight. They ran to meet the Land Rover and danced beside it, shrieking and laughing. The Land Rover came to a halt in the meagre shade under the baobab tree. An elderly white man climbed from the cab. He wore khaki safari clothes and a wide-brimmed hat. Complete silence fell, and one of the oldest boys fetched a carved stool and placed it in the shade. The white man sat on the stool. A girl came forward, knelt before him, and offered a gourd of millet beer. The white man drank from the gourd. No one spoke. No one would disturb an honoured guest until he had taken refreshment. But from the grass huts the adult members of the village came. Blinking into the sunlight, winding their loincloths above their waists, they came and squatted in a semicircle before the white man on his stool. He lowered the gourd and set it aside. He looked at them. "I see you, my friends," he greeted them, and the response was warm. "We see you, old one," they chorused, but the expression of their visitor remained grave. "Let the wives of King Nakulu come forward," he called. "Let them bring each their firstborn son with them." Four women and four adolescent boys left the crowd and came shyly into the open. For a moment the white man studied them compassionately, then he stood and stepped forward. He placed a hand on the shoulder of each of the two eldest lads. "Your father has gone to his father's," he told them. There was a stirring, an intake of breath, a startled cry, and then, as was proper, the eldest wife let out the first sobbing wail of mourning. One by one, each wife sank down onto the dry, dusty earth and covered her head with her shawl. "He is dead," the white man repeated against the background of their keening lament. "But he died in such honour as to let his name live on forever. So great was his dying that for all their lives money will each month be paid to his wives, and for each of his sons there is already set aside a place at the university, that each may grow as strong in learning as his father was in body. Of Big King there will be raised up an image in stone. The wives of Big King and his sons will travel in a flying machine to Igoldi, that their eyes also may look upon the stone image of the man who was their husband and their father." The white man paused for breath. It was a lengthy speech in the midday heat of the valley. He wiped his face and then tucked the handkerchief into his pocket. "He was a lion." "Ngwenyama," whispered the sturdy 12-year-old boy standing beside the white man. The tears started from his eyes and greased down his cheeks. He turned away and ran alone into the millet fields.